Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast by radio amateurs with a focus on homebrew electronics. We get together on the internet to swap ideas about radio construction projects. Our website is www.soldersmoke.com. Please send feedback to soldersmoke, that's one word, at yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. Hey, good morning. Welcome to Solder Smoke number 60. It's Sunday, the 27th of May, 2007, rainy Memorial Day weekend morning here in London. It's a three-day weekend here also. It's not Memorial Day here tomorrow. It's just a bank holiday Monday, but everybody's got the day off. So might be able to spend a little bit more time in the shack working on the power supply project. But hey, I just want to let you guys know about something very strange that happened with Google here the other day. After having talked about the Elser Mathis Cup, you know, this is the prize that they have awaiting a winner in the lobby of ARRL headquarters in Newington, Connecticut. This is the prize that goes to the first radio amateur to successfully have a two-way radio contact with Mars. I needed a picture. I wanted to see what the thing looked like because I'd been reading about the fact that it has on it some figures that look remarkably like the extraterrestrial images out of Roswell, New Mexico, and other places like that. So I decided, let me take a look at this thing. So I went to Google and went to the image. You know, you could search for images. So I just put in there Elser Mathis Cup, I think I put, or maybe just Elser Mathis. And I hit images and search. And within about 2 seconds, Google came up with these thumbnail images. And they were as follows. One, a picture of the cup. Two, the Solder Smoke logo. Three, a kind of scary picture of Nikola Tesla. And four, an aerial photograph of my house. I don't quite know how to react to that, but now there it was, and I thought that was kind of unusual. I didn't realize that that we have such close connections to Tesla and the Elser Mathis Cup. Maybe it's an omen. Maybe there's a prize here in the offing. That's the one I'd like to win. I'm not much into awards or contesting, but I tell you, I'd like to have that one. So I don't know. I guess it gives us something to shoot for in retirement. All right, let's see what's next. This is going to have a different kind of an unusual kind of sequence of events here today. I reach over here. Uh-oh, you guys hear it coming? But now I got to tell you something. It's going to be an unusual thing. Let me see if I can get it right. That might have been a little bit too late. We're going to have to automate this. I got to explain. That was the gong, in case you didn't hear it. It wasn't normally, it wasn't at its normal high volume, because I didn't realize that a lot of you guys out there who are listening on MP3 players and iPods, these little devices apparently don't have AGC. And in this case, of course, we're talking about automatic gong control. I got a couple of emails from folks asking me to kind of not really wrap the gong at full volume because they're walking along with their earbud headphones, and we're running risk of eardrum damage here. So I was surprised. I thought that these little players would have AGC in them and would prevent that kind of problem, but apparently not. So now we have to bang the gong softly. It's even been suggested that we might want to have my kids steal the gong again, or go back to, remember this sound? That's the lamp. easier on the eardrums. But anyway, we'll try to keep the gong sound under control. It is, of course, a health and safety issue. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm joined right now by Maria Patricia, 7 years old, just woke up. Let's say hello, Maria.
Hi.
All right, very good. Let's see. She'll be quiet here for a few minutes as she wakes up. All right, so we've covered the need for automatic gong control. Got some good mail this week. Scott Haley, KD5NJR, writes in response to last week's discussion of old radio books by Frederick Terman. And Scott points out that many of these old books are now freely available on the web. And there's a great website put up by somebody who's working real hard to make these old books available online. And I'm going to put the link to that website on the Gadgeteer news page at www.gadgeteer.us. So check it out. I think a lot of you guys would find books there that would be really useful and interesting, especially those who are interested in tube-type old-style radios. Mike found the site. I remember Mike talking to me about it, saying that we needed to talk about it on the show. So thanks very much to Scott for reminding me of that. Got some good, nice email from our friend in Bangalore, Ramakrishnan, and he has been made perhaps inspired by the interviews on Solder Smoke 59 to create a Wikipedia page for West W7ZOI. I think it's a completely appropriate, and so Ramakrishnan has it up there. Apparently, there's some sort of rule on Wikipedia. I'm not familiar with it. We're trying to figure it out about whether you can do a wiki page for an individual. I'm thinking you should be able to, but there's some sort of warning that the Wikipedia people put up there about the possibility of this page being taken down. If anybody knows about that, please let me know, and I'll pass the information on to Ramakrishnan. But we'd like to keep that page up. I think Wes deserves it, and is certainly a notable figure in the homebrew and QRP and electronics world. So, yeah, why not? check it out too. Just go to Wikipedia and search for him. You'll find it there. Our musical maestro, Moj Johnson, the guy who came up with the music, the new music for Solder Smoke. He was at Dayton, and he sent me an email saying that an image of my shack, my London shack, appeared in one of the talks. And I'd like more information about that. I mean, I'm very pleased, of course, but I'm just wondering how it managed to work its way into the presentations at Dayton. Anybody knows, send me an email. I'd like to learn more about that. And Moj asks me whether he notes the Drake 2B. See you later, Maria. He notes the Drake 2B in the shack and asks if I have it, if it's just sort of something I've had for a while, or whether I hold on to it because I really really like the piece of gear. Well, I really like the Drake 2B. So if you have one, if you have the possibility of getting one, Moj, I'd go for it. It's a beautiful little receiver. I mean, I have kind of a nostalgic emotional connections to the receiver, if that's possible. But anyway, I've had it since about 1973, so yeah, I think it's a keeper, and I use it every day. We got lots of mail about the W7ZOI watt meter. I'm not watt meter, but power meter, and about my comments about temperature and noise and the kind of no signal reading that pops up on the meter when you have nothing connected to it. And I made mention of the fact that this signal that you're seeing there is basically just the temperature-related noise in the input components. And a lot of guys wrote in providing additional information on that. Let's see what we have here. Some real good ones. Yeah, Roger Hayward writes in and says, in the introduction to RF design, if you look for the discussion on thermal noise, you'll see that a resistor, say the 51-ohm termination, generates about negative 174 dBm per hertz at room temperature. If you scale this up to 500 megahertz, then you're on the order of negative 80 dBm, and that is roughly where the 8307 reads when you turn the unit on. Yeah, so there we go. We've done the math, and it explains it. It says, Roger goes on, if you were to put the meter in the fridge, yes, the measurement would go down, but it all depends on how cool you can set your fridge. Remember that the thermal energy is based on Kelvin, which doesn't have anything to do with where water freezes or where lettuce freezes. To get the reading to go down by 3 dB, you'll have to take the temperature from 300 degrees Kelvin to 150 degrees Kelvin. Ouch. Thanks for that, Roger. Then we have another one on this from Steve Reinhardt, W1KF. He says, Bill, you're on the right track when you consider that noise is related to temperature. There's an online calculator at sengpilaudio.com/calculator/noise.htm, where we see that VN, the noise voltage, is equal to the square root of the product of temperature, resistance, bandwidth, and a constant. What you need to remember is that the temperature in the equation for noise is absolute. So room temperature is around 293 degrees Kelvin or 20 degrees C. The interior of your refrigerator is probably 273 degrees Kelvin and your freezer 263 degrees Kelvin. So the difference between room temperature and the freezer is 263 divided by 293, or 0.89, meaning you would have about a 10% difference in noise based upon temperature, measurable but not significant. Now Steve goes on, says something interesting about the cold cameras used in astronomy. The cold cameras used in astronomy often use dry ice for cooling. That can bring the image sensor down to around 195 degrees Kelvin. Now, the reduction in noise in the image sensor is 33% down from ambient. That is significant and can enable longer exposures. And if you get to LN2, liquid nitrogen temperatures, at only 77 degrees Kelvin, the noise is only a quarter of room temperature. So dropping the noise component into a bath of liquid nitrogen will see a significant decrease in measured noise. Trouble is, the solid state device has resistors in it which contribute noise, and some semiconductors don't like operating at 77 degrees Kelvin. Thanks very much for that, Steve. We have an interesting email. Oh, we always get interesting emails from Alan Yates, VK2 Zulu Alpha Yankee, VK2 ZAY. And he points out some experiments that he's doing here. He says, this evening I threw together a little three-stage amplifier on a solderless breadboard, driving a charge pump to give me a noise to DC conversion. Unshielded on the bench, it floated around as I approached the circuit, picking up hum, etc. But it appeared that heating the input termination resistor with a lighter flame did make a significant difference. I was just watching the DC trace on the scope drift up a few millivolts. One interesting thing I noted was that there was a small but non-zero resistance that minimized the output. 47 ohms, oddly enough. Either way, up or down made the output increase. This may be the resistance that terminates the first stage for best noise figure, but it is not equal to the input impedance, but it wasn't too far from it either. I replaced the input resistor with a torch bulb a little flashlight bulb, and focused some heat onto the filament with a magnifier lens. This was very noticeable, despite the filament being only 3 to 4 ohms resistance cold. I'll get a higher resistance bulb and try again. I figure the bulb with a hard vacuum, rather than backfilled with an inert gas, will work better, letting the filament heat up faster and to a higher temperature. Ah, interesting experiment there, Alan. Very good. Looks promising anyway. I'll rebuild the circuit on a PCB and shield it. Then I can think about making a Dickey switched version with a lock-on amplifier to really try making a bolometer with it. I might also try that just precision measuring of a high resistance filament with a bridge or a small test current. This might be sensitive enough on its own without any thermal noise measurements. Regards, Alan. Thanks for that, Alan. Really interesting. Let us know how that works out. To bring this down to the kind of more basic level here, some of the experiments are really pretty sophisticated. I remembered a passage in one of my favorite electronic books. There's been some discussion on QRPL about what are good books to use to teach electronics. And I have one here. Mine is falling apart. It's being held together by glue and duct tape. And the pages are really almost in as bad shape as the pages of my original version of Solid State Design. But it's a book, little book called From Atoms to Amperes by F.A. Wilson. It's part of the Bernard Babani series published here in London. And I picked mine up years ago, and I think the thing is out of print, unfortunately, but it's a really good introduction to kind of the physics of electronics. And he has a brief chapter on on noise. And he says as follows: Within a conductor, free electrons move at high speeds in all directions, linking up with positive ions and breaking away from them in a purely random manner. At each end of the conductor, the net charge is a function of the number of electrons and positive ions near the end and their distance from it. Because this is a random process, i.e., the numbers of particles in their locations changed in an unpredictable way, then at any instant, it is unlikely that there will be exactly the same charge at both ends. Hence, there is a minute charge or potential difference across the two ends of the conductor, and this is when nothing else is connected to it. That's the key point. He gives some figures here. He shows some typical conditions. Let's see. In the figure, this action is extended over a longer period of time. The graph has been drawn by the simple expedient of using random numbers obtainable from tables, computers, and some calculators to give a realistic impression. Averaged over a period of time, many times that of T2 minus T1, an answer of around zero can be expected. In practice, a noise voltage reveals itself as a hiss from a loudspeaker when it is fed by an amplifier of high gain. It is also responsible for the multitude of white flashes on a TV screen when the antenna aerial is disconnected. Generally, in a conductor, the number of free electrons and their velocities increase with temperature because the added heat provides them with more energy. Accordingly, with more free and more energetic electrons available, the end charges and their differences are greater. Hence, the noise voltage increases with temperature. There is a well-known formula for calculating this voltage. Development of the formula is beyond us here, although at least we know part of it, having studied the relationship between particle kinetic energy and absolute temperature, Boltzmann's constant. Thanks very much for that, F.A. Wilson. I think it kind of explains it really very nicely. All right, moving on here. Some news from Norway. Our friend Thomas, LA3PNA, is now designing DC receivers using the AD831 chips. And there's been discussion about this, I think, on the Experimental Methods for RF Design Yahoo group. I think anytime somebody's working with a new device on new kinds of receivers for ham radio, it's interesting. And I think Thomas's work is particularly encouraging because Thomas is significantly younger than most of us. He's last time I checked, I think he told me he was 19. So we have a young designer in the group who's listening in, and I think everybody should be very happy that he's doing that. I think pretty soon he's going to probably show us what he's working on. He's been talking about it on the Experimental Methods group, so I don't think I'm revealing any lab secrets here. But fine business, Thomas. Keep up the good work and show us your design when you're ready to launch it. Saw an email that come across QRPL list. Kanga USA is running a special this weekend, and this weekend only, on handbooks and ARRL handbooks and Experimental Methods for RF Design books. Bill has some good prices there, so check out the Kanga USA website, and you'll see the offers there. It looks like a good deal. Let's see. Oh yeah, I wanted to also mention talking about the ZOI power meters. It's important to note that there's more than one Hayward designed power meter out there. There's the ZOI meter, but there's also a power meter. This one is a bit more digital. It has a PIC chip in it and a digital readout by Roger Hayward, KA7EXM. And kits are available for that one also. So those of you who are more digitally inclined might want to check out Roger's version of the power meter. I'm still playing here with my one with the big needle on it. I guess that's a sign of my analog roots. All right, let's see. Oh, I put some new videos up on the Gadgeteer Solder Smoke video page. There's a lot of interesting videos coming out of the Maker Faire that they had in San Mateo, California last weekend. A lot of electronics, but Maker and the Make blog and Make zine, it covers a real wide range of, I guess what you could call, homebrew and homemade activities. Some of it of interest to us, a lot of it not. But they have some, it's always worthwhile to take a look at what they're doing, what they're working on. And they had this big fair in California last week. And I caught the video where they built some truly huge Tesla coils. I mean, they look like they're about, 8 or 9 feet tall, two of them, with some pretty sophisticated control equipment hooked up to them. And man, they fired these things up, and it was like, whole main lightning bolts. And of course, this would be of interest to the Solder Smoke Gadgeteer QRP homebrew community. Although it certainly didn't look like QRP to me, but hey, it sparks. So check out the video there. You'll see these machines in operation. They even sound good. You could hear the when it starts to arc, when it's starting to really deal with the air dielectric there. You could hear it sort of kind of snarling and snapping and getting ready to put a big arc between the two coils. And they had them situated, it looked like, about 6 to 10 feet apart. So some big sparks there at the Maker Faire. All right, speaking of kind of fairs and expositions, of course, while Maker Faire is a little bit, like I said, some of it's unrelated to what we do, we're still in the immediate aftermath of the big event of Dayton, and more specifically, 4 days in May. Last week we had some really good interviews from Dayton, and this week we have three more. Our correspondent Bob Crane, W8SX, has sent in three, I think, really, really great interviews. I know everybody here will be interested in them. We have first there'll be an interview with Jeff Hecht, K8GD. He is the winner of the homebrew competition there. Jeff is a hardcore home brewer. Jeff won, hands down, the first place in the homebrew contest at FDIM this year. His rig was really quite a tour de force in design. I asked him to describe the design process with inspiration from other HF designs and construction methods. He is a Manhattan builder and a long way from ugly. I think you guys will enjoy hearing Jeff talk about his project and his thoughts on home brewing. And congratulations to him for winning the competition. And there's another interview here that I know the group will be very interested in. Bob got us a really great interview with Eric Schwartz, WA6HHQ of Elecraft, and Eric talks in some detail about the K3, the new sensation that's sweeping the QRP world. And here you have an opportunity to hear direct from Eric about Elecraft's new creation and about how they think it's going to affect home brewing and the technical characteristics of the new rig also. So thanks very much to Bob and to Eric for that interview. And finally, we're going to wrap up this week with an interview at Dayton from John,
WB8RCR.
And he spoke about micros at Dayton. And he also talked about friendship at Dayton, the meeting up with old friends, and the fun of the hand bench and 4 days in May. So thanks very much to John for that interview, and thanks again to Bob for getting us all of them. I will put on the interviews right now, and you'll hear them in that sequence.
This is Jeff Hecht, KGD, and I designed and built a 160 through 10 meter single sideband and CW transceiver using building blocks from various other designs and things. For example, the VFO is built on a DDS VFO design based on some work that I've seen from Craig Johnson, Alpha Alpha Zero Zulu Zulu. The receiver is based somewhat on Jim Corchi's 2N2 designs with modifications for sideband and also for the various switching of the crystals in and out for the IF, different IF frequencies. The transmitter is more or less pretty much my design with a few adaptations from the K2, the power amplifier in particular, using a pair of 2SC1969s in push-pull, biased at class AB, to give me roughly about 30 watts out at about 14 volts on the power supply line. And, it works splendidly. Workstations on nearly all of the bands. The only one I have not worked, a band that I haven't worked a station on, is 12 meters. So I've worked stations on 160 through 10, minus 12. Haven't done anybody on 12. So if the band is open and you hear me calling CQ, I'd appreciate it if somebody would give me a call back, and then I will have worked all bands on the new transceiver. So that's a quick rundown of the design of the K8GD ABR1, the ABR standing for all band rig. Yeah, very, very original there. But that's the design. I hope to have schematics and a little more detail on the web as soon as I find time to actually get them into the computer correctly, or drawn correctly, I guess. They're in the computer, did quite a bit of modeling using LDSpice for a lot of the circuits, and then but they're not really in a usable fashion to duplicate. So hopefully I'll have some schematics here over the next few months that people can then go out and look and just point out everything that I did wrong. No. Anyway, so that's a quick rundown on the rig there.
And the construction method was?
Oh, the construction method is Manhattan style. Specifically, the VFO was very difficult to put together. It uses an Analog Devices 9854 chip, which is an 80-pin surface mount device, and I used a Schmark Boards Yes, that's right. Schmark boards, SCH, you know, in the beginning of that, to put the AD9854 analog devices chip on a prototype board such that I could use it. There's a few other surface mount devices that are used in the rig. The microphone amplifier, or preamplifier, I guess I should say, is a surface mount device, and then nearly all of the coupling caps and the bypass caps are all surface mount devices as well. So,
okay. And the people this year at FVIM gave you something as a reward for that project.
Yes. Being the first place winner in the building competition, I was happy to receive from Telepost Incorporated an LP100 vector power, you know, meter that is just fantastic. I was just blown away by such a nice prize for that, and I can't wait to get started building that.
Hi, this is Eric Swartz. I'm WA6HHQ. I'm one of the two owners of Elecraft, ham radio manufacturing company here at Dayton. And we're here at Dayton showing off our new product, the Elecraft K3. We've been sort of overwhelmed with the response. It's been quite an interesting weekend. A lot of fun people to talk to, a lot of interesting experiences having different people we really didn't expect that would be interested in our radios come up and give us a lot of enthusiastic response. It's been a great time here. Dayton's a pretty crazy place. I think we've got about, 20,000 people here, or close to that here, maybe more.
Maybe, I think closer to 30,000.
Maybe even 30,000, yeah, this weekend. And I think a good number of them walked by where I was standing in my little booth at the show here. But it's been an awful lot of fun.
How long have you been developing the K3, and what do you expect it to do in terms of how it's different than the K2, which many people are familiar with?
Well, the K3 certainly grew out of our development of the K2. You know, K2 was as a kit radio, you know, like the old Heath kits, a fairly high performance radio for its class, and we certainly wanted to do that plus one step in the K3. And what we did is started talking about it 4.5 years ago. Wayne Burdick, my partner in this business, and myself, and had several other technical advisors involved in the company who we had close friends who worked with us on a couple other designs. And we started in earnest working on the product probably about 3 years ago with the goal really to come out with both a next generation, sort of next step up from the K2. We didn't want to replace the K2, but we wanted to actually supplement it with a higher performance radio that maybe had a little more size to it in terms of panel space, certainly involved ergonomics, custom LCD displays rather than the off-the-shelf components that we used on the K2, custom design knobs, bezels, you know, things that we could do in terms of now that we're a larger company, be able to get that done. But also we wanted to take what we've learned in our development of radios over the last 8-9 years since we started the company, and fold that into this next generation product. So we added a lot of high power DSP, digital signal processing, to the back end of the product that allows us to do both fairly advanced filtering on the product, but in addition, noise reduction, auto notching, in band equalization on transmit and receive, you name it, all sorts of bells and whistles. But on top of that, we didn't want sacrificing the receive performance in terms of dynamic range, the ability to hear weak signals in the presence of strong ones. So we took our sort of classic architecture that we developed in the K2, single conversion in that case, to a fairly low IF. They were at 4.9 megahertz, and we stayed with something similar in the case of the K3. We convert directly to our first IF at 8.215 megahertz, and we can narrowly filter signals at that level down to 200 hertz even, or maybe even a little bit less. So it gives us a very effective front end for a radio, which then converts down to our DSP IF and allows us to, in tandem, have both very narrow, high-performance crystal filters in the front end with DSP filter in the back end. So we ended up with a pretty fun product, and it's ergonomically sort of neat. It looks certainly very polished, and the units we've built have all performed very well. It's been sort of exciting getting this out there. But probably the most exciting thing, and somewhat surprising, we obviously hope for success with this radio, but we've been sort of overwhelmed with the positive response we've gotten from really a wide range of amateurs, both in the contesting community, the QRP community, the DXing community, the building community. We offer this radio both as a modular kit, which is a departure a little bit from our old kits, where you could have plug-in parts, soldered-in parts in all the boards, like in our K2, which we still offer that way. This one actually has all the components mounted on the printed circuit cards that you can assemble into a system, something like a PC when you build it yourself. Though a bit more than that, you align the radio. We walk you through the theory of operations as you build it. And so we appeal both to a new crowd of builders that maybe didn't have the time or skills to build at the soldering level, but we also give them hands-on where they actually know how the radio works so they can go in there and hack it or change it or repair it if they need to, which is fun. We also offer this built, too, so that's obviously a wider audience. And so the combination of those things has been pretty wild. We've just been, I haven't had a lot of sleep the last couple of days, let me put it that way. So if I sound a little bit fatigued here, that's probably why.
You know, I don't operate a lot of phones, so I don't know how to do that. Hey, I'm John McDonough, WBRCR, and I spoke on micro applications and QRP homebrewing at FDM this year. And, you know, I mean, part of my picture was that, hey, guys who don't take advantage of micros these days are making things too complicated, which is kind of the reverse. But this is a good FDM. You know, George is always wonderful. I mean, if you haven't heard George Dobbs speak, I mean, it's always an experience. I have to say, I really, really enjoyed Wes Hayward. I thought he had a very arcane topic, and I was not looking forward to it, but boy, did he make it fascinating. You know, I mean, he really did. And I don't know how we did on attendance this year. It seemed like we had maybe more people than we had in previous years. We've got, that was my understanding, about 300, and I think that's a little more than we've tended to have, and that's good. Certainly got a lot of response from vendors. I think the vendors are up from at least 2 years ago. I come every other year, so vendors are up from 2 years ago. A lot of cool stuff. A lot of cool stuff. You know, DIZ there has got a whole bunch of little bitty modules on boards, kind of after the George Dobbs philosophy of little tiny building blocks. And, you know, M Cubed has always got new toys, and it's amazing. It's amazing. But, you know, it's always about the folks, though, right? I mean, you come, you see your old buddies year after year, and you don't get to see these guys all the time. Well, you know, Stafford shows up everywhere like a... but you know, you get to see guys like, you know, Korcha, and Doug Hendricks was there this year. That was great to see, to finally meet Doug. I hadn't met him. I see Jim quite a lot, Korcha. But you know, guys like Preston, you only see every other year when I come to FCIM. So great to see everybody, and no rain so far.
All right. Well, excellent. Really fine business stuff. And thanks to everybody who was involved. Next week, we're going to do something a bit different. We're going to have kind of an old-style QSO. We have somebody out there who we've been wanting to talk to for a long time. Joined us on Echolink. And so we're going to have a two-way QSO. I think everybody will find it interesting. It's a bit of, give you a little preview here, it's a bit of QRP TV meets, well, I'd say homebrew TV, I'd say amateur logic TV meets solder smoke. We had a lot of fun with it, and it was good to have a dialogue, a little back and forth. I'm going to try to do some more of this here with Solder Smoke in the future, and I think you guys will like it. I certainly enjoyed it, so we'll have that on next week. But that's it for this week's edition of Solder Smoke. Thanks for tuning in or walking along with it in your iPod or MP3 player. Please send email and feedback and ideas, and have a real good week. 73 from London.